what are transgovernmental networks? How do they operate? And how come you became interested in this topic and started to research it?
The G7, the G20, the BRICS, they can decide things faster. Fungi, bacteria, do not know borders. They don't need passports to get in. The Pan American Health Organization has focal points in the majority of the countries throughout the Americas. Health cooperation in North America is driven by interests, whereas in South America is driven by ideology.
Do you think that we should change the model, or do you think that we should stick to this model and then make adjustments to the extent possible?
You know, and due to climate change, now even Argentina is worried about dengue. Well, even Europe is nowadays worried with dengue. Neither the interests nor the values converge between Canada, the US, and Mexico, which means this is the right moment to design new organizations, to invite other countries. You have to deal with those issues, because if you don't deal with those common threats, what will happen is what happened during the COVID pandemic.
Welcome to New Regional Orders, a podcast by the Center for Regional Integration. I'm the center's founding director and your host, Ivo Ganchev. In today's episode, I'm delighted to bring to you the first part of a two-part conversation that I had with Dr. Octavio González Segovia from Flaxo, Mexico. For those of you who are not familiar with the acronym, Flaxo, Mexico is a branch of a prestigious intergovernmental research organization, which in English is called Latin American Faculty of Social Sciences. Octavio has previously taught at numerous universities, including the National Autonomous University of Mexico. He has also worked with a number of Mexican ministries and conducted research on several continents. Octavio's current work focuses on transgovernmental networks and health governance, but he has previously published on topics ranging from post-structuralist theory to nuclear agreements. Last year, Octavio contributed a chapter to a book that I edited titled Lessons from Regional Responses to Security, Health, and Environmental Challenges in Latin America. For those of you interested in the book, you can find it on Amazon or at the website of the publisher Vernon Press. In this episode, Octavio and I explore what makes transgovernmental networks effective, how they shape regionalism in the Americas, and why this matters when responding to epidemics. We also compare the role of ideology and interests in terms of promoting or sometimes preventing the development of regionalism. And we draw lessons from regionalism in both North and South America. Octavio is one of the most curious and well-traveled guests that we've had on the podcast so far. It's been a fascinating opportunity for me to talk to him, and I hope that you'll enjoy our conversation. As usual, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on YouTube or on your favorite podcasting platform. So without further ado, let's roll the intro and get started. Welcome to the show.
Ivo Ganchev, Beijing-based academic, executive, and a consultant.
I wanted to try the theory on you.
Yeah, esa es una pregunta para un examen de grado. Para un examen de grado.
Go to the communities and listen to people. And listen to people. And listen to people.
Exploring change across the borders. Welcome to New Regional Orders.
And it's my great pleasure to welcome to the show today, Dr. Octavio González Segovia. Octavio, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ivo.
So let's start by talking about a topic that's really a unique part of your research, transgovernmental networks. You're the first guest on this podcast that specializes in this area, and this is a term that can seem quite broad. Can you explain briefly, what are transgovernmental networks, how do they operate, and how come you became interested in this topic and started to research it?
Sure. We could think about transgovernmental networks as like-minded clubs in which you want to join because you share some values that interests as well with the other members of the organization. These organizations are usually small, react fast, have a horizontal structure, are not hierarchical, unlike intergovernmental organizations. And besides, they reserve the right to admit those who share their values and interests. An example of that could be, for example, the G7, the G20, the BRICS, or the MICTA group. All those are transgovernmental networks. They are transgovernmental networks because they integrate sub-officials who have the power and the delegation of their respective governments to make decisions on behalf of the state. That is, the state is represented on the second level. Even if there are meetings between the ministers of, let's say, health, defense, interior, etc., the ones who prepare the field in advance, the ones who make the decisions, are either the undersecretaries or vice ministers, or the ones below them. In the case of the health security realm, we're talking about the directors of international relations. Transgovernmental networks have a very limited membership, which means that unlike the IGOs, the membership is not universal. And one of the reasons why they are so effective in many respects is because they can decide things faster than IGOs. They don't need to go through very lengthy processes of decision making. It's easier to share a consensus with those who share the same values and interests than you do, like what it happens within the G7. As you can recall, when Russia was a part of the G8, the values and the interests were not exactly aligned, even in a field like health.
This is a really good overview to begin with, and I hope that the distinction you drew between intergovernmental organizations and transgovernmental networks will be really useful to our audience. Now, we're in Mexico City today, and you very graciously welcomed us here. And Mexico is, of course, a part of Latin America as well as North America, so it's had multiple regional identities. So when you think about regional integration here, Latin American politics, Latin American integration, or perhaps even integration of the Americas, how do you see TGNs contributing or hindering regional integration processes here in particular? And what are some of the key transgovernmental networks that we should be aware of in the region of the Americas?
Well, one of them is the Global Health Security Initiative that integrates the G7 members and Mexico. It's a very successful organization that has been in place for about 24 years. It started in the aftermath of 9/11. And in fact, 9/11 was one of the reasons why then Secretary of Health Tommy Thompson decided to cooperate with his peers from Canada and Mexico. And since there was already a sort of cooperation going on with the Europeans and Japan, it made sense to integrate Mexico because of the common border, which extends more than 3,000 kilometers, in this, as I said, like-minded club. Despite the fact that the values of Mexicans are not similar to the values of the American, the Canadians, or the Europeans, not to talk about the Japanese, the U.S. couldn't escape that geographical reality. You know, the viruses and fungi, bacteria, do not know borders. They don't need passports to get in, unlike us, and particularly during these times. So that's one of the organizations that we should always have in mind, particularly because unlike other TGNs, mm-hmm. which transform themselves mm-hmm. or which evolve into a treaty or a treaty-related intergovernmental organization, the TGN has been there for a while. And the TGN has even expanded its scope to include other security related areas, like, for example, nuclear and radiological cooperation, to name just one. You know, even when it comes to disaster management, after the Fukushima nuclear disaster, the ministers of health of the G7 and Mexico, that is, of the GHSI, decided to share knowledge, which is another relevant aspect of TGNs, the fact that they are good at diffusing and exchanging knowledge. And another important thing is the fact that these organizations make their decisions based on evidence. So at the end, even if there is a power imbalance, as many of my interviewees from the G7 and Mexico told me, it is the scientific evidence that makes the difference. That is, the best argument is the one that wins the conversation. Not necessarily the fact that the Under Secretary of Health from the US is sitting next to you. From what they told me, from what my interviewees told me, the members of the organization respect their scientific knowledge. And since they all share a similar background, you know, they went to the same universities, they speak the same language, they even interact in English during their meetings. It is that at the end, it's easier and faster to reach a consensus and to go for a common solution.
Yeah, this really highlights, I guess, the efficiency that you can achieve through TGNs. And you've also very interestingly mentioned some of the fundamental problems that they can help us address, whether it comes to security or whether it comes to health. Now, speaking about health, we recently had the COVID-19 pandemic, and we collaborated on a book on lessons from Latin American regional integration and a number of areas, including health as well, where you wrote a fascinating chapter titled Institutional Factors Influencing the Success of Latin American Organizations Confronting Epidemics. Can you share some of your key findings? What are these institutional factors that determine the success or, I guess, failure of regional organizations in responding to health crises?
Well, in the case of the pandemic, but also in the case of some other epidemics and health crises we have had in the last 12 years, what we have witnessed is that there are substantial differences when it comes to how different regions decide to collaborate. what instruments they use, what knock, what doors they knock to get help or to get vaccinations or technical assistance. And when it comes to South America, most of the countries knock on the doors of the Pan American Health Organization. That is the first door they knock. And it's like that because, according to what the interviewees said, the resources, the human, financial, and technical resources that the Pan American Health Organization has to confront epidemics, irrespective of the source, irrespective of the sort of disease, it doesn't matter if we're dealing with Ebola, Zika, chikungunya, yellow fever. The Pan American Health Organization has focal points in the majority of the countries throughout the Americas. So it's easier to call them for assistance whenever you need it than to go to, let's say, a regional grouping. However, in the case of North America, we see something different. We witness not only the appearance of more and more TGNs throughout the years, but also we witness that TGNs, as Anne-Marie Slaughter called it in that very famous and relevant article, Disaggregated Sovereignty, that it is becoming the preferred vehicle of cooperation. And it is becoming the preferred vehicle of cooperation, particularly among North Americans and among North Americans and Europeans, particularly when it comes to security issues, not only biosecurity, but also when it comes to dealing with money laundering, terrorists, cartels, and also security issues related to finances. So in my research, I realized that South American countries are particularly driven by ideology. So whenever there is an alignment in the left, we can observe more collaboration. You know, health, education, culture are areas that interest the left parties more than the rightist parties, at least in Latin America. And when rightist political leaders are in power, what we witness is not just the opposite, but it's also the dismantling of the health-related organizations. And I'm referring to intergovernmental organization created by those leftist political who held power in the last years. One example of that is the UNASUR. And an example related to health is the institute related to health governance, which was based in Rio de Janeiro, and who was led by the Minister of Health of Ecuador. That was a very successful organization, I would say, but it was successful because back then it had the total support of Brazil, the country with the most resources in South America, they provided everything for the functioning of that organization, including the building, the budget, etc. So in North America, cooperation is driven by interest. Even if Mexico or the previous Mexican governments and the current government do not share the same interests, then let's say Italy, Japan, US, Canada, who care a lot about, for example, terrorism, Mexico anyway has to participate and has to relinquish some of its demands. You know, the Mexican government should be more interested in dealing with, for example, tropical diseases. But the GHSI doesn't deal with tropical diseases, unlike the BRICS. The BRICS do deal with tropical diseases, and the BRICS even deal with traditional medicine. And they have an area in which they exchange knowledge concerning traditional practices, ancient practices, which belong to their culture and their understanding of health. So it's not just the focus that the GHSI focus on what it's important for the G7, but also that they are leaving aside some of the diseases that kill millions of people on a yearly basis in the developing countries, like in sub-Saharan Africa. And that implies not funding, for example, their research on those sicknesses. For example, the so-called neglected diseases or the neglected tropical diseases. The South American countries and the BRICS do care, or at least talk more or invest more on those sicknesses, which are the ones that affect them the most. So in conclusion, I would say that integration, at least in terms of health cooperation in North America, is driven by interests, whereas in South America is driven by ideology, be the leftist ideology or the rightist ideology. If there is a moment like the one now in which we have presence from both political trends, then it means no understanding. It means stopping research and collaboration in that area. And at the end, that is one of the reasons why South American countries consider the Panama Health Organization as the first option, not the neighbor or the neighbors. And in the case of TGNs, that's what usually happens. You see TGNs, even in sub-Saharan Africa, formed by countries which are neighbors.
That's really a fascinating analysis, where you've pinpointed a number of crucial issues, including the fact that the BRICS countries do cooperate and have even a greater potential in the future to cooperate in terms of traditional medicine, which is something that a lot of countries in the global south might also be interested in the future. But let me get back to South America, where you drew our attention to the fact that there are shifts between left-wing and right-wing movements in South America, and the ideological factor shapes some trends and trajectories in terms of regional cooperation, especially when it comes to health, an issue traditionally associated or important for the leftist parties. Now, when you think about this sort of change in the focus on health and the way that this affects regional organizations or transgovernmental networks and how effectively they operate. Do you think of this shift as a problem? Do you think that this is something that we should be addressing or policymakers should be addressing when it comes to building regional organizations and cooperation mechanisms? Or do you think it's just something that we should take as it is and then work within the limits of what's possible politically when it comes to alignment between leftist governments? In other words, how do you think we should be building health cooperation mechanisms in the context of South America? Do you think that we should change the model, or do you think that we should stick to this model and then make adjustments to the extent possible within the realm of ideological constraints?
Well, I think it's really difficult to devise both a design and a way out, because as you know, that's been the history of Latin American integration in the last decades. Mm-hmm. We have had so many organizations, and the majority of them haven't lasted. And we witness these changes from one political wave to the other every now and then. But what I've also seen is that there are examples of regional integration that can be more successful and therefore can last longer, mm-hmm. like the Pacific Alliance. Mm-hmm. The Pacific Alliance started as an organization led by governments oriented to the right, democratic principles, values. And despite that origin, with the time and with the political changes within Peru, Mexico, and Chile, the organization didn't cease to exist. And why is that? Because these governments realized that it was helpful and it was effective to all of them. And that's the reason they, instead of eliminating the organization and creating a new one with a different orientation, they expanded the scope of the organization. They included other issue areas that were more relevant to them, while recognizing that their free market economies were meant to cooperate and to join forces, as in fact the four of them did by establishing business representations in third countries, particularly in the Middle East, in Europe, in Africa, sometimes Colombia and Mexico decided to open a common office. Sometimes it was Chile and Peru. And soon other countries in the world realized that it was a good organization, that it was an effective organization, and decided to join as observers, particularly many from the APEC region. So I think there is a way out, there is a better way to design organizations. They would need to be light, unlike UNASUR. Mm-hmm. UNASUR was too rigid, too heavy, too focused on so many issues. It's enough to see the organigram of the UNASUR and compare it with the Pacific Alliance organigram to realize how heavy is the UNASUR vis-a-vis the Pacific Alliance. And it's also important to, and this is what some senior civil servants in Itamaraty told me, when it comes to designing organizations, it is important to first select those issue areas that are not as controversial as others, and start collaboration from there. And they all told me that that issue area, which is the less controversial, is health. And since all South American countries share borders and share similar diseases, particularly tropical diseases, like in the case of the actual organization, it makes sense to collaborate. It's something that that will benefit your standing at home, because you are caring about your people, particularly if it's something like chikungunya, yellow fever, dengue, etc. You know, and due to climate change, now even Argentina is worried about dengue. Well, even Europe is nowadays worried with dengue. So I would say those might be some of the clues to start changing the way we design organizations. I think that to get rid of this problematic situation in which we have, on the one hand, lots of agreements going on in Latin America, and this divide between the right and the left, it would be better for countries to focus on interests rather than ideology or values. Because what we have witnessed so far is that when there is a change in power in any of the leading countries within Latin America, cooperation ends or transforms itself into a new arrangement, into a new institutional arrangement. But of course, that means stopping cooperation for a while. That means starting from zero, getting rid of previous institutional building efforts, experience, knowledge, good practices. So I think it would be better to try to replicate what the BRICS countries are doing, which is to focus on interest rather than focusing on their core values or ideologies. Because at least when it comes to health, we can witness that the BRICS countries are focusing on those issues that interest them the most. For example, to fight tropical diseases or to fight those diseases that provoke thousands of deaths on a yearly basis, like tuberculosis, malaria, which are in fact the diseases that affect countries in the global south a lot. So in their case, they leave apart their respective ideologies. And as we know, we are talking about very diverging ideologies. On the one hand, you have the IMSA countries, you have India, Brazil, and South Africa, which share democratic values. But that's not the case with China and Russia. And since China is one that takes the lead in all these initiatives, then China is the actor that most of the time sets the rules, the cooperation rules. And those initiatives that were born within the BRICS have been successful, have evolved throughout the time, and are still going on. So in Latin America, that might be an alternative in order to to escape moments like the one we are witnessing right now, in which we have a very reluctant Argentinian government to cooperate on many issues along the same lines than the US government. And then you have some other countries like Brazil, Mexico, Bolivia, Chile, which have a different political orientation, different values, and of course a different ideology. But since we're talking about common threats, I think they will need to focus on that, on those threats and on very practical issues. According to what some under ministers and high-ranking civil servants told me in my previous interviews, it is better to start cooperating in those topics which are not so controversial, not so problematic, and which are more appreciated by citizens, like in the case of health.
That's a very interesting proposal that hopefully some policymakers will take note of, making sure that you focus on interests rather than ideology, and also catching the so-called low-hanging fruit, the issues that are relatively easy to address that everybody sort of agrees on. So we've spoken about the role of ideology in shaping Latin American politics, and you also mentioned interests and values. Now, you've worked specifically on regional health cooperation. Can you talk a little bit about how these factors that we've been discussing so far influence health cooperation in Latin America, and what are some of the biggest challenges to achieving stronger regional health cooperation? What strategies can help us to overcome these obstacles as well?
Well, one of those strategies, as I mentioned, is to focus on interests, common interests, and to try to profit from the institutional arrangements we already have, not to start from zero, to continue knock on the known doors, in this case, those regional organizations, but also those American organizations which have worked particularly good and which have been effective when dealing with regional threats. Let it be, for example, the Zika outbreak, or the yellow fever outbreak, or even the threat of Ebola. And in those cases, those countries, the Latin American countries, rely a lot in the Pan American Health Organization and in the focal points established in the different countries throughout the region. What I have seen in my research is that most of the countries which have been more successful in dealing with epidemics or with outbreaks are the ones who rely on different institutional arrangements, that is not only on intergovernmental organizations, but also in transgovernmental networks and bilateral cooperation. Mm. There's no country, not even Brazil or the US, which can be capable of dealing alone with any of these threats. Any of these threats demands cooperation, even if you have strong capabilities like the US does. You still need to cooperate with the neighbors. And you still need to make sure everyone gets access to medicine, vaccinations, and knowledge. And for that, it is important to set networks. Networks in which you can exchange knowledge, in which you can supplement lack of capabilities of your neighbor, as it happened during the H1N1 influenza pandemic, when, for example, the Canadian government helped Mexico analyze the first samples of the new influenza. And it was through collaboration, through regional and bilateral collaboration, that the three governments, covered by the North American pandemic plan to deal with influenza, got along with the threat and got better results than the results we got with the COVID pandemic. When we compare these two pandemics, we realize that one key aspect was collaboration. When we dealt with the influenza pandemic, there was already a plan that linked the three governments, Canada, the US, and Mexico. Back then, they already had different gatherings, exercises, protocols, even manuals to deal with a possible pandemic, because they knew a pandemic would come. They even knew that that pandemic would probably come from China. So those protocols, those manuals were already set. And back then, they already had several years working together, collaborating together, exchanging viewpoints, strengthening the capacities and the capabilities of the neighbor. And that was the case with Mexico, for example. Previous to regional cooperation, Mexico didn't have a specialized lab number three, which means Mexico wasn't able to even determine what sort of threat we were facing. And that was the reason we had to send samples both to Canada and to the US in that order, in order to know what threat we were facing. So that's reason I say we would need to focus more on interests than on common values, because of course, when we analyze the values of the different countries throughout the Americas, we realize that the values are not converging. They are becoming more divergent. And they are going to the extremes in some cases. And I'm, of course, referring to the political spectrum where you see right, extreme right-oriented governments like Milei's Argentina or Brazil when it was under the lead of Bolsonaro. That sort of governments, or like the current US government, provoked that at some point cooperation ceased to exist. That happened with UNASUR. When Milei came into power, one of his first actions was to get rid of UNASUR, to abandon UNASUR. And in the case of Peru, in the case of Ecuador, what we have witnessed when the right comes in power is that these countries design new organizations along the lines of their respective ideologies. But then what happens is that left-oriented countries leave those organizations or create their own organizations. And in a region like South America, you have to cooperate. it doesn't matter if we're talking about a region like the Amazonas or the Andes. All those countries share similar threats, sicknesses, circumstances. And they cannot, as I said before, they cannot do things by their own. They need to share their respective capabilities and resources. And they also need to get the support of the Pan American Health Organization, and they need to work along the lines of PAHO if they want to be successful, if they want to eradicate certain diseases. So from my point of view, the answer, and not only in South America, but in current North America, where we are experiencing so many troubles and divergent viewpoints, is to focus on those issues that are not only important for the different countries, but are unescapable. You have to deal with those issues, because if you don't deal with those common threats, what will happen is what happened during the COVID pandemic, that, for example, Brazil under Bolsonaro decided not to cooperate with the rest of Latin America, and they decided to negotiate a loan with the different organizations, but also with private labs or with the pharmaceutical companies, and they got vaccinations, but only for them, which is exactly the opposite to what Argentina and Mexico did. Since at that time, these two countries were led by leftist governments, they were able to cooperate together, and they were able to reach a deal with the same providers, including, for example, providers from the UK as AstraZeneca. They were also able to reach a deal with the University of Oxford. And they distributed their respective duties. Argentina produced the vaccination, and Mexico was in charge of distributing the vaccination throughout Latin America. And in that way, they not only managed to cooperate with each other, but to help and to supply with the vaccination to all the Latin American and the Caribbean countries, with the exception of Brazil. So we don't want a picture like that, in which the US decides to just look at its people, or Argentina decides to retreat from several international organizations to deal with whatever threats may come, but to try to work together. The institutional arrangements, it's perhaps the less important when it comes to saving lives. That's the reason why many high civil servants in South America told me, listen, we knock all possible doors. We don't care if it's an IGO, if it's a TGN. We don't care if there's not a good relationship with the neighbor, but we have to cooperate. You know, it's health is one of those areas in which you have no alternative. And that's particularly the case because we are more connected than ever. It's cheaper to travel anywhere, and it takes just some hours to reach any of the Latin American countries. And even if you close borders. You cannot really close them. Human beings are not the only carriers of viruses and bacteria. And that happened when we dealt with the COVID pandemic. I don't know if you remember, but there were these Ecuadorian shrimps, frozen shrimps, which were exported to China. And the Chinese discovered that those frozen shrimps carried the COVID virus. So if we don't cooperate, if we don't extend the ways in which we exchange knowledge and make decisions, it will be more and more difficult to deal with the new pandemics and the new epidemics that will happen because of climate change, because of global mobility, etc.
Yeah, you've made a number of fascinating points here, and it's definitely a very specific area of regional cooperation in the sense that the value of human life sort of trumps ideology or profit or any other value that you might hold. And you've spoken about both North American regional cooperation on health and South American regional cooperation on health. Now, if we zoom out a little bit, not just in terms of health cooperation, but in general, you've studied integration in both of these regions, North and South America. What are the key similarities and differences between integration process in these two regions, and what are some lessons that the two can learn from each other and apply in practice?
I think in the case of North America, the problem is not capabilities. Whereas in South America, the problem most of the times is linked to lack of capabilities. Meaning, South American countries should include in their institutional arrangements capable countries that can supply the capacities most of these countries do not have. Like what we have witnessed during the influenza pandemic. Mexico didn't have labs number three capable of analyzing complex and new viruses, fungi, and bacteria. But Canada and the US did. So I think it's important, as we have witnessed in Africa, to include very capable countries in those alliances, organizations, to try to supplement the capacities these countries do not have. Nowadays, Africa counts with several CDCs that enable them to analyze viruses and bacteria and to do their own research and not to be so dependent on the institutes and the centers in both Europe and the US. And we are all interested, or we should be all interested, to install those sort of facilities in all regions. There should be at least one CDC in South America, a very sophisticated center in which we have experts conducting research on the various viruses, bacteria, and sicknesses that tropical countries face. We, of course, have centers like that in developed countries and in some emerging economies, but we don't have them everywhere. And that's, I believe, the reason why we should include very capable members in the new organizations we are designing and constructing, to make sure that no one is left behind, that there will be a knowledge transfer between members, that all of them will adopt similar practices, which are also the best practices, the best possible practices, for the sake not only of the region, but for the sake of the world. And in the case of North America, we will face more difficulties than in the past, because nowadays, neither the interests nor the values converge between Canada, the US, and Mexico. What we are witnessing now is that there is a bigger convergence of interest between Canada and Mexico than between the US and Canada or the US and Mexico. Which means this is the right moment to design new organizations, to invite other countries, and to try to limit cooperation to those issues in which we will all agree, in which there are no major disagreements. Health is not the only venue where we can reach easier agreements or even a consensus. There are others linked to climate change that might be of interest for all the countries. Like, for example, fighting natural disasters. You know, it's not like trade. Trade now is a very contested issue. Whereas fighting natural disasters, like what has happened in the last weeks in California, where Californians got the support of both the Canadian and the Mexican governments to fight the fires, the massive fires they had. That's a good example. I believe that there are still some issue areas in which governments, irrespective of ideology, irrespective of political orientation, can and should collaborate. I would say the major difference between South American organizations and North American organizations is that in the case of South America, but that includes Mexico as well as part of Latin America, there is a predilection for intergovernmental cooperation. Yeah. Whereas in the case of the US and Canada, there is a predilection for informal clubs, that is transgovernmental networks. Of course, they offer advantages when compared with international regular organizations, IGOs. But they have also black spots, like, for example, the fact that they are not accountable. They are not under legislative surveillance. And in fact, most of the times, we don't know these organizations are in place. We don't know how they function. We don't know, in some cases, how often they meet. What do they agree? What are their protocols, their guidelines? They are usually very opaque. So we should weigh those advantages and disadvantages. But if we face a threat like a pandemic or a threat related to climate change, we have no alternative but to cooperate irrespective of the institutional arrangements.